Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring the intersection between food, agriculture, and competition. Learn how a chicken raising contest in the 1940s led to the poultry industry we have today.
And they were going to run a contest and try and develop what they would call the chicken of tomorrow.
We'll also venture into the world of agricultural video games, where a new set of tractors is making a lot of fans happy.
The biggest addition to 19 was the John Deere's. That's what everyone was hyped for.
And we pay a visit to a group of Indian restaurants that aren't on the friendliest of terms.
Usually they wait for my restaurant, but after long wait, they go to next door or downstairs. But this is how they do business. They completely copy whatever we do.
Embrace your competitive spirit and be the first to listen to new Meat and Three episodes by subscribing now. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network, you know, Tuesday, you know, whenever, from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, joined as usual with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez, Matt in the booth, and special guest.
Nastasia said nothing.
I said the hammer.
I know.
And we got Jack Schramm, head bartender at Existing Conditions.
Hello, good afternoon.
With us as our special guest, call
different,
in.
Different feel to that news.
What?
Why did the energy get sucked out of the room when you talked about Jack?
And Jack Schramm, head bartender at Existing Conditions on West 8th Street in New York City.
Hello.
Better.
Okay.
So call in all of your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. So when they announced Nastasia, I know you probably weren't listening, but now that you are theoretically listening, she's got one earphone on.
Yeah.
We're being sponsored today by Forever Cheese. Forever Cheese. Don't you have the Rod Stewart Forever Young song in your head now?
No.
But with the word cheese in it?
Sing it.
I'm not going to sing Forever. Jack will sing Forever Cheese.
Forever Cheese.
Forever Cheese. Forever Cheese. Right? Forever Cheese. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I think they should pay Rod Stewart. He seems like a friendly sort of fellow. And like allow themselves to do a Forever Cheese parody of Forever Young. What do you think?
It's a good idea.
Winning? 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 I also, Matt, had some comments to make on the Meat and Three topics for this week, but I forget what they are, so I can't.
I am eagerly awaiting them.
What?
There's a caller.
There's a caller?
There is a caller.
All right, caller, you're on the air. What's up?
A couple questions about smoking.
Okay.
And then also the eggs with the big yolks.
Eggs with big yolks. Go. Go!
So, eggs with big yolks. I've got chicken. I can make eggs with really big yolks, and do you think there's a market for it?
Let me ask you this. Are you willing to say what it is that you do, or is this like a like some sort of technique that you have that you want to have be a competitive advantage? I know I like a big yolk because there's something I don't like as much, the whites. Unless I am making an Ange Foo cake, which, P.S., Ange Foo cakes are delicious. Yeah. Not because they're fat-free, because that would make them seem like they're garbage. But in fact, they taste good. They taste good. But I would always prefer, in a poached egg scenario, I would prefer...
If you're eating an egg, you want more yolk.
You want more yolk. You definitely want more yolk. Yeah, yeah. So, but anyways, are you willing to say how you accomplish this, or is this
nothing proprietary. I'd be happy if it caught on and like these higher quality eggs on the market.
All right, so
that in my mind would be a positive thing.
So how do you do it?
So if you imagine like foie gras,
yes,
except the goose would go willingly and eat as much food as it can. And that's kind of what chickens do.
Are you a Spanish liar?
Am I a what?
Are you a Spanish liar?
No.
Okay. Because
you imagine it was something willful, right? Yeah.
Well, like, that's what the Spanish say. There's this guy in Spain who says
it wants,
but you have to not. Now I'm not even using a Spanish thing. He's like, you have to tell it. The theory is, he goes, if you look at the goose, it won't eat everything to get a foie gras. So if you look at it, it's not gonna make a foie gras. But if you don't look at it, I didn't force feed it. That's that Spanish guy that Dan Barber profiled, where he says that he has these geese that just. They love it. They love it. You know what I mean? And yet, I know a lot. I don't know if you know this. I know people in the food industry. I don't know anyone, not one human, who has tasted this foie gras. It is miraculous foie gras that requires no force feeding. All right, go ahead. But you're saying you got chicken feed that is just so freaking good that these chickens just jam it all in. Is that what you're telling me?
So it's more of and I'm hoping this works out because I just invested in 150 birds. To try and get this up and going, get the product to market. But so if you imagine chickens have such like an impulse to eat, and the way that their system works with their crop is they're constantly digesting all day. So I can go out and I make like a lard or a tallow, depending on what I have. Render it all down, mix in a little bit of feed into that, and then put it in the freezer and chop it up. And then so I can go out 3, 4, 5 times a day, and I can feed these chickens and throw it down, and no matter how much they've eaten, because I'm showing up and it's new, they continue to eat.
Now, I know chickens are not vegetarians. Chickens are not vegetarians. Everyone should get this out of their head. Chickens eat worms and bugs, all sorts of stuff. But do people give you crap about feeding beef fat to chickens, or do they not? I just don't know what the current...
I haven't really shared it that much that I'm doing it, that anyone would give me crap, and if they did, I mean, that's too bad.
Yeah, okay. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, they eat meat.
I have two questions about this.
Feed my chickens, and I fell on this by getting bigger yolks in the winter when I was feeding more tallow on you know, up in Vermont here when it's negative 25, giving more fat to process, and then the next day the yolks would be just humongous.
I like this.
So it's a high labor process, meaning it can't be like an automatic feed system. So you have to go out and like appear and spread the chickens. The chickens are out free ranging, and they see me coming and they just scram to chuck all that fat. And then you also get really nice fricassee chickens when they stop laying.
Ooh.
So because they're on such a high fat content, when they're done laying, older hens, they're like dynamite stew hens.
Here's something Nastassia does not like the word of spent layer hens.
He should send this one.
But what you're saying is, I'm
do
sure
you want
that,
it live or dead?
Yeah, the taste of a spent hen, right? Obviously good from an old school chicken soup kind of a situation. But some people are put off by the texture of old birds. I don't mind the chewiness because I know that they're going to taste delicious. Does the feed ratio with the high fat actually like affect the texture too, or just increases their flavor profile?
Increases the flavor profile. It's almost like it just makes a really you end up getting like really big fat pads inside the bird that I just leave in and cook and just don't eat them. But it flavor profile I think is a lot better.
Okay, so now I've also never researched the fat content of poultry, the fatty acid profile of poultry based on the fatty acid components of the food that they eat. I have researched it in pork and in cows. So I'm curious, you're feeding hydrogenated fats to the
No,
birds.
not hydrogenated.
Well, not hydrogenated. That's not what I meant to say. Solid fats. That's what I meant.
Right.
Saturated is the word I meant to use. Sorry. Correction. So you're feeding them saturated fats. Does that affect the fatty acid profile of the yolk? Does the yolk have a different kind of action to it aside from size?
I would say it's deeper in color and it's definitely fattier.
But in other words, have you tried feeding them some sort of more liquidy fat, if that's possible, to see whether you get a different texture of the egg yolk?
No, because up where I am, you know, everyone and their neighbor raises their own meat. You get farm fresh meat everywhere at grocery store prices, and the tallow in the lard. Your average homeowner doesn't know what to use. So I go up to people I know, and they'll have like a whole chest freezer.
Your average homeowner's a jerk. Why don't they use it?
It's true.
Why don't they use it? Anyway, well, I'm glad you're using it. Yeah.
And so I get it for a song. Okay. You know.
So if it takes a pound of feed to make X number of eggs normally, forget the labor for a minute. It takes a pound of feed to make X number of eggs. How much
more?
Third
of a pound, typically.
What?
Third of a pound of feed.
Okay. So how much in this new technology does it take to get an egg?
You know, I haven't done the math because I just kind of go out and throw and they eat what they eat.
Right. I'm just trying to figure out how much more these are going to have to cost.
Oh, good question. So when I'm doing the fat, their feed production goes down, but their foraging goes up. So when I'm into the fat, they eat next to no grain, but they eat a ton more grass to compensate, I think, for the high fat content.
Okay, so you're
just
saying
naturally.
So you're saying that the feed is not necessarily the issue in price.
Right. It's the labor.
Okay.
Because in order to do this, I've got to be on location. It's the labor that goes into it. You've got to be attentive to them to get the really, really, really big yolks.
Okay, so give me a baseline for, like, farmer-style eggs, where you are, and then what you want these to sell for.
These would probably end up wholesaling for probably $5.50, $6 a dozen once I factor in the labor rate. You know, 150 birds are going to give me roughly, 10 dozen eggs a day. And so you're being attentive to these birds for 10 dozen eggs a day.
Wait, so you're telling me that for under 50 cents an egg, because you're not going to use this for baking or cooking. You're only going to use this for showing off the egg, right? So it's not so bad.
Right. So the target market is actually like, mom and pop country store that does breakfast sandwiches in the morning. And they just want to up their game and give a really solid product.
So, like, I don't know what a dozen. So, obviously, there's garbage eggs, which are, I don't know what they go for, like $1 a dozen. Less?
Yeah, up here, most people. There's a company called Maple Meadows. They're kind of a medium sized egg producer that's local here. People pay about $2.50 a dozen for them. But they're commercial. The commercial ones, commercial pack. I can't think of the word right now. But anyways, what they buy in bulk are usually the odd-sized eggs, and then they have the regular eggs going into, or the two-ounce eggs, the perfect two-ounce eggs going into their retail packs, and you'll get a mixture of big and small eggs in the wholesale. So with this, I'm hoping to push the all-uniform jumbos out as the wholesale product. It's probably going to end up being twice the cost.
Yeah,
which, when we're talking about a dozen eggs,
I would pay for that for a Benedict or a toast. I would like to see one of these eggs. I'm interested in the technology. An odd size egg was my nickname in high school. No. All right.
So the only hiccup that I've had in this is when the birds get really scared, there's an increased rate of heart attack.
Well, because they're fat. Yeah. All right.
So like we got hawks, and the hawk will dive bomb, and the heads have good protection, so it'll scare the crap out of them. And I've had a couple drop dead from it. But besides healthy birds, and there's no force feeding.
Yeah. You lost Nastasia until scared to death by a hawk, and then she was like, okay.
Well, it happens by a regular chickens too. They just kind of die.
Yeah. Well, it's a known fact that with things like pigs, when they have doubled muscles, very lean, and but actually it's the reverse. They're lean, but they're doubled muscles. They get frightened and they keel over and die. They're like,
yeah!
Anytime you force something beyond its normal kind of parameters, it's like living on the edge, and then it can keel over dead. All right. Nastasia's going to rip my head off.
Stress, man.
So we have to do, if you have a smoking question, it has to be within 10 seconds. I have to be able to answer it within 10 seconds.
Awesome. Hot smoke versus cold smoke, when you're cooking sous vide, before or after sous vide, what's the best technique?
Hot smoke and cold smoke taste obviously very different. When you're cold smoking, you have to worry about you have to worry about food safety. With hot smoking, you don't need to worry about food safety because you're increasing the safety as you go. So if you're throwing a light smoke on it, you're going to cook the hell out of it anyway, and it's a relatively big piece, I would just hot smoke it for less time, pull it out before it gets overcooked, and then cook it through on the sous vide. If you're doing it for a crust development, obviously anything you put in a bag is going to get wet and soppy and it's going to need to be crusted up afterwards. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So can I safely do sous vide and then do a cold smoke after?
No. If you do a cold smoke, you're putting it in a situation because you haven't wiped out any of the anaerobic stuff that is going to be on it, right? You've wiped out the vegetative cells, but you haven't wiped out anything. So if you put it in any sort of situation where there is a possibility of spores turning back into vegetative cells and producing toxin, then sous vide is not going to help it unless there is a surface treatment that precludes botulism growing or other things. So no, you aren't. I mean, obviously you're killing vegetative cells, so you're enhancing safety, but you're not making cold smoking on its own safe. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So the other part of that is when we harvest our meat birds, I just got a cabinet pellet smoker. It fits 12 birds at a time, 12 big birds at a time. The thing's monstrous. And can I do a cold smoke on them and then not worry about the growth and do a deep freeze to like negative 14? To kill the bacteria?
No.
And then pull them out smoked?
No.
But raw?
No. Deep freeze will not kill bacteria. Deep freeze will just, I mean, it might kill some, but freezing is only considered a kill step for worms and parasites, not for bacteria. Yep. So it stops them from multiplying, but doesn't stop them from existing or being there. So the only way to, if you're going to cold smoke it, if you can actually keep it cold, i.e. at 40 degrees, right, then it's just like storing it or 40 degrees or below in Fahrenheit land, then, you know, okay, now you can smoke it as though it was in a vacuum bag prior to cook. So you have it for as long as you would have in a vacuum bag prior to cooking to smoke it. Then you can low temp it. But if you're cold smoking it for hours and hours and hours at a temperature in the quote unquote, which I don't believe, but the quote unquote danger zone, then you're in it for a world of hurt unless you actively stop the bacteria from growing.
But smoking after, so jumping back to the cooking, smoking after sous vide won't swamp out the sous vide texture?
No. I mean, it depends. If you're cold smoking it and you're keeping it cold.
Hot smoking.
Yeah. It depends. It depends on how big it is and how long you're going to smoke it, right? So, I mean, again, everything depends, but like a big horking piece of meat, if you're going to smoke it for like 20 minutes at a hot temperature, then you're not going to overdo it. You know what I mean? Like, probably. Well, if it's a small piece of meat, you could overcook it easily in 20 minutes. I mean, if you're going to do it industrially to chickens, not semi-industrially, then I would just invest in keeping them, actual refrigerator temperature. I'd make sure they're salted properly. I might even nitrate them a little bit so that no one gets pissed off at you. And then do it for a couple of hours at refrigerator temperature and then sous vide it. You should be fine.
Man, so no nitrates. My wife's allergic to nitrates and nightshades. So I don't do, my life sucks when I have to cook for her.
Yeah. Sorry about the whole nightshade thing. Nightshades are delicious.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Last time I called in, I was talking about reverse osmosis milk, maple sugar. So I've got like 3 or 4 farmers that are interested in it and a couple of people with sugar houses. Like, we're waiting until after season. I think we're going to run some and see what happens.
All right, call us, let us know.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Forever Cheese sources the highest quality and most unique cheeses and other products from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia, and imports them to the United States, many under the Mitika brand. If it's Mitika, it's got to be incredible. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Michael Harlan Turkel, and I'm the host of The Food Scene here on HRN. This show explores the intersection of food, art, and design by talking to people who are inspired by these ideas. The show features food photographers, food stylists, interior designers, and so much more. All the players that make the world so visually delicious. You can find The Food Scene wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, Dave, I actually emailed Stas a few days ago about this question too, but then got a chance to call in. So my sister is getting married in August, and there's going to be like 50 people there. And she wants me to cater her wedding, which sounds like fun. It's going to be outdoors. We'll have an oven, a stove, a barbecue, immersion circulators, no deep fryer, and we'll have plenty of other equipment as we need. Any general suggestions would be welcome, but also we're going to be doing a first course before the wedding, which we hope to be kind of prepping our mains during that time, during when people are cycling in, so that we can actually participate and be at the wedding. And so something that is full prep ahead of time, doesn't need to be monitored in terms of temp, is not going to weep out, and just kind of easy to have out so that we can do other things while people are munching on it. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, you live in the Pacific Northwest, so if you're not worried about poisoning people, and I mean, you do have to get temperature because it's crushed ice, but everybody loves a raw bar, and you got all that kind of crazy good raw bar stuff up there.
I would love a raw bar. My sister doesn't like oysters.
See, in your question, you said there were no dietary restrictions.
There are no dietary restrictions. I should have said my sister does not like oysters, however.
Have you considered getting a new sister?
She's pretty good otherwise.
Okay. All right.
I know. A raw bar would be so good.
Yeah, you could do you live in like Gooey Duckville. Can't you get some Gooey Ducks? You know, rip the, everyone who's not seen videos
Look
of removing the skins off the Gooey Ducks is like one of the good, more suggestive cooking procedures. I like that stuff.
Well, yeah.
So like right now, because I read the question, I was like, you should do a raw bar. They live in the Northwest.
Yeah. And then I should have mentioned that.
Yeah,
but then I should have mentioned that.
So there's a lot of things that are good cold, right? Charcuterie. Like, it depends. Also, here's what you didn't say in your question, right? How fancy are the people, right? Because it's like there's a question of like, you know, the weddings that Nastasia goes to, there's yellowtail on the table. You know what I mean? I'm just making fun of her. She's making fun of her. I'm making fun of her friends, not making fun of Nastasia.
She's just attending the weddings and enjoying the yellowtail.
No,
she's hating the yellowtail. So the side joke is that whenever people come over to Nastasia's house, she's like, "You brought yellowtail, I cooked you a meal." Anyway, and so like the point being, I don't know how fancy your friends are because, you know, there's lots of things that are incredibly simple that can sit out forever, but they ain't exactly fancy. You know what I mean? So it's like, what level
of fancy? I think the first course doesn't have to be super fancy. So the rest of it's going to be, it's going to be summertime, so there's going to be great produce. And so for kind of like the first of the mains, this is going to be like our charcuterie, cheese, fruit, tomato.
Wait, your mains is going to be the charcuterie? Because I was about to go charcuterie.
I jerk.
The self jerk, strong.
Well, that's going to be the first main. And then the main, which is all going to be at the same time, is going to be like some salmon and like prime rib.
Because you know what else is really good as an appetizer is a cold whole filet of salmon with the dips. Like, it, fantastic first. Yeah, I mean,
we might just go like fancy popcorn. Like, I don't know.
Hey, listen, anyone on the chat room has an idea or tweeted, because my old school stuff that used to like sit out forever and was fine is you get a table with a, obviously any dips.
Yeah, just do like a mezze platter.
Any
just
dips.
Just like baba, hummus.
Yeah, yeah, but like
vegetables.
And I'm actually going to say something Nastasia enjoys here, like artichokes. You like prepped artichokes. Artichokes are delicious.
Delicious.
And they can sit out forever. Like, if you're doing salmon for your main, because blah, 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 Pacific Northwest, like, a cold chicken roulade, like, that you then slice up and you can, like, fan out and you can have with, like, little toasts and things like this is
duck
nice.
Rillette.
Oh, my God, rillette. Any sort of rillette. You know what I like? I like a three-meat choose-your-rillette.
Ooh.
Where you got the duck rillette, you got the pork rillette, and then rabbit. You could do rabbit, which I enjoy rabbit. But the problem is that you don't want this to parasitize. If you're going to do a charcuterie thing, you don't want this to parasitize your charcuterie. Here's another thing I'm going to mention to you. Your sister is going to be freaking busy. getting married, so she ain't going to eat the first appetizer anyhow. You're going to be lucky if she gets one fork full of food in her face the whole freaking day. You're going to have to actually force her to eat if she's getting married. So it would not hurt to have some oysters and some raw bar out there for the people who are normal. You know what I mean? Else. For the normal people.
That's a good point.
As long as there's other stuff that she can eat, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you can have a nice mignonette. You can have a nice cocktail sauce. You know what I'm saying?
Are you doing drinks for this wedding thinking, also?
Like a shrimp cocktail. Everyone loves shrimp cocktail.
Well, most people do. Who is it that doesn't like shrimp? Is it Nastasia that doesn't like shrimp?
Nope.
No, it's not you or
it's
no?
It's not me.
Somebody I know doesn't like shrimp.
I don't like that person.
Yeah. Well, shrimp is good. Shrimp, though, shrimp is like, whenever you eat a shrimp, you're like, imagine if this was crab.
That's true for most crustaceans, though.
Whenever
and
you
we
eat,
have, we have, I mean, we have a ton of Dungeness out here.
Yes, I'm familiar with the crabs on your part of the world, but the problem with them is they're a huge pain in the behind to pick.
But God, are they good.
So unless you're going to pay someone else to pick them for you, like, or you want to spend the entire morning picking the meat out of Dungeness crabs, it's kind of a freaking nightmare. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I've done it many times. Yeah, many, many times.
I once ruined a Valentine's Day dinner by saying it was going to be done in a reasonable amount of time and then deciding to make Dungeness crabs. Like, and my wife doesn't enjoy, like, cracking apart decapod crustaceans and ripping the meat out of them. So I had to crack and pick it all. And she's like, are we gonna eat now? This is not a sexy Valentine's Day. Look, waiting for your husband who has crab pieces sprayed all over his face to pick out.
That's an aroma, too.
It's a sweet, sweet aroma. And the aroma is repellent if you hadn't had to do it. So if you get to eat the crab, that's good. But then you have to go to sleep with the person who's been coated in crab juice.
Yeah.
Whose, like, hands have, like, literally been tattooed with crab stink based on the, like, shells going through his fingers as he was picking the crab out. Not a good look. Or smell.
May I just say, too, just for the record, Dungeness crab right now around here is $5.99 a pound. And in my opinion, it's superior to lobster.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's
100%.
Yeah.
Look, lobsters, here's the good thing about lobster, people. Like, I happen to like lobster, but in the pantheon of things, crab is way up high.
Much more delicious.
Way up high. Then underneath crabs are most shrimp forms, like the larger prawny ones. Mm-hmm. Are a little. Then comes lobster.
Yeah.
And, like,
Carabineros up there.
But, like, the nice thing about lobster is it's just big and it's easy to get. It's easy to get to. Like, a lobster is the fastest, like get full. As long as, see, I actually eat all the little parts of the lobster.
Oh, yeah. Squeeze all the meat out of those legs.
So it takes me a while to do it. But the average jerk, who just eats the tail and throws the rest away, like, I can have the tail out of a lobster before I can tell you I'm getting the tail out of the lobster.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Done. Like, crawfish, by the way, below lobster.
Yeah. But good.
They're good.
Yeah.
They're good. Crawfish, that's why the thing people mistake about crawfish is it's all about the soak after the cook. It's cook and soak because the meat itself is flavorless because they live in fresh water. Most freshwater things, and this is actually the failure of many shrimp, is that they're grown in too fresh of a water, right, because they're farmed. And so, like, things that live in fresh water, I mean, an exception in certain fish. I mean, like, I like a trout. Is trout really flavorful or is trout good smoked?
After you smoke it.
Yeah. So the point being that, you know, lobster is good, but it ain't no crab.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, if you have any other thoughts, throw them out, but thank you for the help.
All right. Let's know how it works out. Alex wrote in with a follow-up, asked us about cooking the Canadian geese. As everybody knows, geese are the devil, and they should all be shot, either turned into coats or comforters or food. But I've never eaten a Canadian goose, so this was the follow-up. Alex says, we were correct to call the meat squidgy rather than tender. After 45 minutes at 57 degrees Celsius, which is, by the way, about 135 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a good number for duck breast, it was extremely tough and chewy. After about 3 hours, it had tenderized somewhat. And after 4 hours, it was reasonably tender. Although, I have to say, long cooking something like this to make it reasonably tender usually just makes it so your teeth can break it up, but it makes it fibrous. What do you think about that word, Nastasia? You don't mind fibrous?
No.
She doesn't care about anything. She's like, I'm done thinking about this. I know this is my job to think about this, but I don't really care. I just don't care. You disgust me so much, Dave, that I can't even think about what you're saying for 10 seconds. But it was becoming increasingly sour with a pronounced dog food aroma. The dog food aroma is probably some sort of protein breakdown product or some sort of – maybe it's what I call livery. It's that livery note that things get, which is, let's just say, unpleasant in a goose breast. These attempts all ended up in the compost. Since the higher temperature seemed to help, I also tried 60C, which is 140 degrees Fahrenheit for you people who are keeping track of this. After 4 hours, the results were comparable to 57C, tender enough for dinner. I should note that these breasts came with no skin and fat. Arrgh! The meat was extremely lean, presumably because they lead an active life in the wild. Are these results typical of wild meats? I mean, usually they're leaner, except for if you get like the official wild birds, you eat them when they're in their gorging. So I've never had an ortolan, but like super fat because it's like eating a lot. Or bobolinks, which is the rice bird. They eat a super lot and they get fatty, fat, fat, fatty, fat, fat. Hey, Nastasia, remember that time I ate a woodcock in front of you?
I know. I knew you were going to say this.
And I sprayed the guts all over your face.
Oh, that
the look
good.
On Nastasia's face is maybe the best look I've ever had while sitting across from someone at dinner. The look was complete disgust and revulsion. It was like.
Was that after the pear thing?
Was it? Yes, we went to Hicks. Yes, it was. Daniel from Cleveland, Ohio, writes in about soda. I have a question about making sodas at home. I have a carbonation rig and a box of bag-in-box Diet Coke syrup. Strong Diet Coke move, by the way, people. I like some Diet Coke. You know who else likes Diet Coke? My partner, Don.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don drinks it.
Nastasia, you a diet soda hater?
I don't like diet.
Don't like diet? Do you like soda, though?
Mm-hmm.
But you don't like diet?
No.
I'm not a diet person.
Matt?
Oh, he's busy talking to someone.
He's got a lot of people in there.
Okay. I like diet soda. I find that if you are buying, I think I've said this on the air before, if you are a not diet soda drinker, right, and you are buying diet soda for a gathering or party, know this. Diet soda drinkers drink about 5 times as much soda as you do, as a sugarful soda drinker. So if you think that 1/5 of the people are going to drink diet versus regular, then you should get the same amount of diet as regular because they will drink 5 times as much. Okay? Just letting you know this. Because people who drink diet soda consume it as hydration, not as a sweet snack. We drink it as hydration. Just a little word to the wise. So I've been carbonating water to about 50 PSI, but when mixed with the syrup at a 1-5 dilution, which is, simple syrup, 50 bricks, simple syrup that we would use at the bar, like that usually to get a soda-y kind of thing runs usually in about 1-4, right? But that adds too much syrup, makes it not as carbonated. So most syrups have a higher bricks and they're running, which is another reason why they like to use corn syrup because it's thinner at those brixes. They're running higher so you can do a 1-5, just FYI. The end result is still pretty flat tasting since so much of the fizzy water has been replaced by flat syrup. Not just flat, Daniel, warm. Are you chilling your freaking syrup? Because there's two problems you have. One, it is flat. Two, it is probably warm, and the warmness is killing you almost as much as the flatness is. Would you agree, Jack?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking about mixing the syrup with still water and carbonating the whole shebang, but I'm worried I'll run into problems there, too. You will not.
I can't feasibly think of a problem you would run into there.
You will not run into a problem.
Mix it, chill it, carbonate it.
Yes. Now, if you're doing it in a keg, the problem you're going to have is that 99.9% of the people don't know how to carbonate in a keg properly. They do a wretched job and they suck. They should be punished for what they have done. It's about getting the air out, and then you can't possibly agitate enough unless you put a very small amount of water in the keg and shake it real hard. Even I read one of the instructions because we ordered one at the bar for one of these recirculating carbonators.
Yeah.
And the instructions in it are wrong because they don't have you purging out the air that's in there, and the air in a system, unless it's purged properly, is never going to go away because it doesn't dissolve. So it's, where is it going to go? Jack, where is it going to go?
There. It's just going to stay.
It's going to freaking stay there.
Yeah.
And then that makes you a jamoke. Or as our last caller said, jerk, jerk! Okay. Paris wrote in, about this last week. We mentioned it, even though Nastassia said I didn't mention any of the calls. She's a liar, as usual. My name is Paris. I have a couple of questions about the use of food-grade lye. I'm currently testing out a deep-fried pretzel. Remember we talked about
this?
Yes,
I do.
Oh, now you remember. So Paris was doing a bake, then a lye, then a then the fry. That's going to saponify your oil somewhat. Reverse it. See what happens. Also, have you seen, I know everyone's been talking about it, but this freaking bagel thing on the internets where these idiots have been slicing the bagel in the wrong way and everyone's mad about it?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know why that happened?
No.
It's because it was in, first of all, you know why it's St. Louis style? Why they said it was St. Louis style? For those of you that don't know, just look up St. Louis bagel slicing. It's because that's what Panera's is called in St. Louis because that's where they're from. And they're doing it to Panera's bagels. And so the thing is, they're like, it's a good way to sample a bagel. No, it's not a good way to sample a bagel because... because it's like the equivalent of not knowing what direction to cut a ham. The difference between – it's a different texture. It's like you can't get the chewiness proper of a bagel by slicing it vertically. You can't be done.
No.
And the issue is Panera, you're just not making your crust chewy enough to have it be an accurate bagel. And this is why you think it's acceptable to cut it the wrong way, in my opinion. Remy writes in.
Hold on. Wait, we got a question from the chat that's specifically for you and Jack. So while Jack's here, I feel like we should maybe do that one.
Okay.
Yeah. Are you fans of incorporating smoke into cocktails? I ask this because there's an ancient Arabian technique of bringing mastic to its smoking point, capturing it in a vessel, pouring water into the vessel, and then sealing it. When refrigerated, the result is a clean pine/cedar tasting water 15 to 30 minutes later.
You are a clean pine cedar flavored water.
That's rude, Dave.
I like mastic. There's also, are you familiar with the Thai funeral candles?
No.
Yeah. So you take it, you light these scented candles, and then you put them in a thing with like custard. You put a cloche over it, and the thing gets scented with the smoke from the stinking candle from Thailand. I'm paraphrasing. Yeah. A Thai person can tell me what an a-hole I am. But that's roughly what happens. So look, anything is traditional. I mean, I think it's cool trying it. The question is, does it taste good? I mean, I think find that most times I don't want smoke on my thing. If it's clean tasting, great. Most smoked cocktail things that I've had are more on the acrid side.
Almost exclusively acrid. I've never had a smoked cocktail that I enjoyed. More than just the cocktail without the smoke. It's just going to affect the balance in a negative direction.
Jack, you like frankincense in a cocktail? Nastassia hates it. I am on the fence.
I can't say that
I've
ever had
it. My wife hates it. Nastassia doesn't. Do you like the smell of frankincense? Do you like the smell of church?
No.
Is that why you don't like it?
I think I could make a nostalgia cocktail that I would enjoy based on the aroma of church.
But only people who have specifically frankincense aroma church as like a what's it called? Reference. You know what I'm saying?
I feel like it's just going to end up being musty.
No, it's like weird. It's like floral and weird in a weird way. It's weird. It smells like frankincense.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you're again it. What about mastic? I like the smell of mastic.
Yeah,
I like
it too. Yeah.
I like mastica in a thing, but I've never heard of burning it. Anyway, I'll try anything because I'm just saying that I don't often have things that are quick smoked that don't taste acrid. Now, we all, not all of us, actually, I just lied. Not everyone likes peat, but like we like smoky flavors when it comes from things like peat, but they tend to be moderated because there's a lot of steps that it goes through after the smoke has been applied to a secondary item, peat. Then you get that burning, then that gets into the malt, then the malt gets fermented, then the sucker gets distilled, blah, blah, blah. A lot of steps to mellow it out.
If I'm going to add smoke to a drink, I'm going to use a peated scotch or a mezcal. That like a smokier mezcal, not one of the more vegetal ones. And I'm going to add, you know, I can add a very controlled amount.
Is that your high school angst movie, The Veg Ones? The Vegetal Ones?
Oh, yeah, The Vegetal Ones.
Yeah. Remy writes in, some friends and I are hosting a fundraising dinner, and one of our cooks would really like to work with liquid nitrogen at the dinner, both for desserts and cocktails. We're home enthusiasts with little to no professional experience, but who have played around with modernist techniques for years. As a long-time cooking issues listener, I'm familiar with some of the health and safety issues regarding liquid nitrogen, but I'm looking for a detailed guide to safely using it in a home setting. We found a place that we can rent a doer, and I'm familiar with basics like never sealing a container with liquid nitrogen, never having even the possibility of serving cryogens to a guest and not keeping it in an enclosed space. What else do I need to be on the lookout for? Thanks, Remy. Well, I'm assuming that it's not a German porn site anymore. Go on cookingissues.com and look for the liquid nitrogen primer. I go through a lot of the safety things there, and most of that stuff is still, you know, still good. When you're the main thing I'm worried about you is when you're transporting it, is like making sure that when you're transporting it to, that your car isn't sealed up, or that, you know, the best is to have it in the back of a pickup truck. That's the ideal. And Jack, you want to tell them the liquid nitrogen safety song?
All right.
Whether you want to or not, you want to get.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense without the dance, so we can save that for another time. But there are 10 things to consider when handling liquid nitrogen. Protecting your hands, not wearing baggy or loose-fitting clothing, keeping a safe distance while someone else is pouring, using a firm grip while you are pouring the nitrogen. Don't wear jewelry because it can freeze and burn you terribly. Protect your eyes while you're pouring. At least, like, don't allow it to splatter into your eyes. Like, we never wear eye protection at the bar, but just be careful. Be a person.
Don't put yourself in a situation where splashes could happen.
Yeah. Have a clear path to the exit. Be in a well-ventilated area. Don't use it alone. Make sure someone knows that you're using liquid nitrogen. And don't leave it unattended.
Remember that time I accidentally spilled liquid nitrogen all over Nastasia at that event?
Well, it wasn't really a spill. You threw it directly into her face.
I didn't throw it in your eye.
It was
Fortunately, it hit the side of your face.
All right, hold on. Okay, Scott writes in about jungle birds. I need Jack for this one. There's two questions I need Jack for, so we got to do it. My name is Scott, and I'm a bartender out here in L.A. I'm struggling with the jungle bird. Give me a jungle bird spec right now, Jack.
Well, I can tell him right now that the thing he's struggling with is that Cruzan's Blackstrap is no longer good.
Yeah. I know. That's what this is about. But give the spec on
it. Yeah, so it's like 2 ounces of rum blend, which is, you know, generally at least an ounce of Blackstrap. And then I like it with at least, you know, 3/4 of an ounce of Jamaican rum, maybe something else going on there too, usually all aged. And then, you know,
Appleton's.
Yeah. No. You know, I'm more of a Smith and Cross and a Jungle Bird.
Okay, so you want some Mega
funk.
Hogo.
You want some Hogo Funk.
Okay.
Hogo Funk, Blackstrap. You know, human recipe is like 1 ounce of pineapple juice, 3/4 ounce of lime, half Campari, half simple.
Okay, there you go. Enough. That's the standard.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm struggling with the jungle bird. A lot of really good jungle birds out there that I've had are based around Blackstrap rum with heavy molasses base to balance out the bitterness, but I don't want to have to rely on that because you can't anymore.
Yeah, but you could buy Blackstrap molasses.
Every experiment I've done to try to balance out the drink without Blackstrap breaks apart because the moment you add citrus to bitter aperitivo like Campari, the bitterness shoots up exponentially. On the other end of the spectrum, without the citrus, the sweetness is super high like a Negroni. I work at a bar with more than 90 Amaro and have tried 10-plus aperitivos to see if it makes a difference, but all of them are the same. Do you know why citrus and Campari have this reaction? Campari gets more bitter over time when stored with acids like citrus. I remember 100 episodes you mentioned this, blah, blah, blah. Is there any research out there to figure out why this happens, or some sort of acid you can add that doesn't have this reaction? No. You have a side note, by the way. Eucalyptus oil is considered to be toxic, but eucalyptus itself is on the generally regarded as safe list. As someone who does more research, how is this possible? It's because of concentration. It's the same reason why Eugenol is not safe, but clove is, because it's just concentrated. Now, Jack, your solution to this problem is?
You're not adding enough sugar.
Well, no, he's saying Blackstrap.
Yeah, buy Blackstrap molasses and add it to a rum and then taste it like that. But it sounds like the reason that it's too bitter is because you're not adding sugar. It sounds like you're just doing pineapple juice, lime, Campari, rum.
Let's assume they're not. But like you're saying, add some Blackstrap.
I think what
you
need to do is...
You ran tests on it. You literally ran tests on this. And how was it?
It becomes delicious.
Okay.
What you need to do is make sure that the drink is balanced.
Yeah. But the point is that you can just buy Blackstrap molasses. Yeah, what brand do you use?
What's the yellow
bottle? It's the one with the goddamn barrel. I mean, I would never use that stuff on its own. Garbage.
No, but yeah.
Anyway, all right. Let me see. Isabel from Vancouver, BC, Canada writes in. Thanks for taking my question, Nastasia. If you're still interested in keeping track, I'm a 30-year-old woman married to a 31-year-old man, and I buy all the appliances and kitchen stuff I desire, a lot more than he does, in fact. I'm not in a financial place to buy a Spinzall yet, but trust me, I will eventually get it. Every year or so, my friend who has an amazing kitchen but doesn't cook, so sad, which is so sad. It's so sad.
What's the point?
What's the point of having it? It's like, you know what? I have a really nice bathroom. I don't poop. Anyway. Hosts a party for some of our closest friends, and my husband and I cook a meal for everyone. Usually, they are themed. Last year, we did Mexican food. This year, we'll be doing Italian, or as Nastasia says, Italian. We have the menu sorted out, but the cocktails are a work in progress. I'd like to offer up Negronis. That's good. Limoncello. And something with grappa. I have to say I'm not a huge fan of grappa on its own. By the way, it's hard to say you're not a fan of grappa on its own because they are widely variant.
So just get some Romano Levy and tell me you're not a fan of grappa.
I like the Nardini, the one that says Aquavita, grappa. That stuff's
tastes
good.
Jacopo Poli makes some good grappa.
Anyway, so there are very different grappas out there. Not all grappa is crappa. I'd like to make it amazing. I'm not a huge fan of grappa, but I'd love to create an amazing cocktail with it. And I'm open to pretty much anything that isn't too sweet. My father, of course, if it's too sweet, you just
David,
hit a trigger.
It's just not too sweet.
You just hit a trigger with Jack. Because, of course, it's not going to be too sweet because it's going to be...
balanced.
There you go. What you mean is you want it on the less sweet side. That is a valid thing to say.
Yes.
Yeah. It isn't too sweet. My father-in-law brings us grappa and grappa miel, which is like... from Uruguay, which is Uruguay grappa with honey in it, which I've never had. You ever had that, Jack?
No, I'd like to try it.
Yeah. As mentioned above, we don't have a spins all yet, so that's the only tool I can't really use. The party will be in about 4 months to ensure we can use the best in-season tomatoes. Any ideas? Thanks in advance. Give me some grappa cocktails.
Just drink grappa. Just...
You're being unhelpful.
I know I am, but like it's a category of spirit that I don't have a ton of experience making cocktails with because of a price point issue. There's one grappa on the market that's reasonably inexpensive. It's called Grait. It's fine. It's good in martini style cocktails as sort of a split base situation. You can make a sour with it easily that tastes like a sour. There isn't really a great way to highlight the character of grappa.
Some grappas are really rough.
Yeah.
Some grappas are more stemmy and seedy, and some are more grapey, right?
Yeah.
So, like, if you're getting a grapey one, then you could just do a Fiend Green.
Just do a sour.
So the Fiend Green is Bobby Murphy's drink, and it's Armagnac, right? Which is
unaged Armagnac.
A blanche Armagnac, so on the grapier side, right?
Well, and obviously, if you're doing a...
Lemon,
a, yeah.
Chartreuse, a little bit of chartreuse, and then tarragon, a little bit of parsley, and chervil... That's delicious.
It is delicious.
And you could nitro muddle that. That would be delicious.
Do they have access to liquid nitrogen in their home?
I don't know. No, but you could blender muddle it.
Yeah.
I also once did a grappa and pumpernickel actually go well together, and grapefruit. So you could do like grappa, pumpernickel, soak the grappa.
Acid adjusted grapefruit.
Yeah.
I'm sure it would be delicious.
Yeah. So I did. I did but I did like an acid grapefruit
grappacopter
grappa with I'd soaked the grappa in pumpernickel bread and then squeezed it out. It was good.
All right, here's a spec for you that I'm certain will be delicious. So the acid adjusted grapefruit we're talking about is 40 grams of citric per liter of fresh grapefruit juice. So 1 ounce of that, 1 ounce of the grappa of your choice, 3/4 Chenar, 3/4 Aperol.
Okay, so Jeremy, you have a question about Liquid Intelligence. I will get to that next week because it takes longer to read it than they will allow me to continue to speak here on the air. Also, Sid, how do you pronounce Thor's hammer?
Mjolnir.
Okay, Sid says, Miss Nastasia. Say it again.
Mjolnir.
Lopez and the engineering crew, you said hello, but I'll deal with your big green egg question. Actually, you know what? I'll deal with it real quick. So in short, you want to use a big green egg. Now, bear in mind that I am not a big green egg kind of a person because big green eggs are all about maintaining a temperature over a long period of time. And I'm all about, so I use like a cowboy grill and heat it up to 8 billion degrees, or a tandoor and heat it up to 8 billion degrees. I'm not so much with maintaining. I'm not about maintaining, but the big green egg is all about maintaining. So it's a different style of cooking. And you want to use an also-ran big green egg. I would do this. Here's something, and this is my last piece of advice, and I could talk more about it next week, Sid. But the point is that I found out something new recently. You familiar with Fake Spot?
What is Fake Spot?
Nastasia, you know Fake Spot? No. So go to fakespot.com. Go to Amazon. Get the URL from Amazon. And then go to Fake Spot. And then Fake Spot does an analysis. Now, it's not 100% because it's a computer-based analysis. Does an analysis of the reviews of that product to try to figure out whether they're real or whether they are BS. And it analyzes the language of all of them. It analyzes the language and everything. And then gives a letter grade based on based on like how, you know, accurate they think the reviews are in terms of whether a human who knows what they're saying has left it. And the product that you linked to got a D on FakeSpot. Now, it doesn't mean that that's true, but when I went and looked at the negative reviews, one of the negative reviews was someone who said it's fine if you already know how to use a Big Green Egg or other expensive Kamado grill, but it doesn't keep temperature as well, so you have to be very skilled in using it. And a couple other people said the cast iron grate in it tends to be too brittle and shatter with use. And another person said that the bolts melted off. Now, they might have just been trying to use it like I would as a jet engine, right? And then I wouldn't blame them or blame that. But just read about it and look and check out FakeSpot for all of your reviewing. And Jack, thank you for you coming on.
Always happy to be here.
Matt, see you guys next week or listen to you, whatever we do, cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, or connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage, and thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.